May it please this honorable court, Mr. Pearson. This is an appeal of a workers' compensation case arising from the death of an oil field worker named Alan Wayne Welch in Sweetwater, Nolan County in April of 1979. After being missing from his job in the oil patch for a period of time, Welch was found drowned in a frack tank containing crude oil. In the trial court, the respondent was the plaintiff, Texas Employers, the petitioner, was the defendant. For convenience and clarity, may I refer to the parties simply as Welch or the plaintiff, or Texas Employers as the defendant. After the jury failed to find that Welch had died within the course and scope of his employment, the trial court rendered judgment that the plaintiff take nothing. Welch then appealed the trial court's judgment to the Court of Appeals at Eastland, who reversed the trial court's judgment and remanded the case for new trial. Texas Employers petitioned this honorable court for an application for writ of error, which was granted on rehearing. Now, basically, the facts of the case are that Alan Wayne Welch, in April of 1979, was employed as a derrick man by Jolly Well Service. His duties included gauging or attempting to determine the level of crude oil in a frack tank. Now, the evidence was that a frack tank is a very large, cylindrical, multi-gallon tank or barrel into which crude oil flows from the well. It has a ladder that runs up one end of the tank, has a hatch on the top of the tank, and then a ladder running down inside of the tank to the bottom. Now, this hatch is a small hatch. The exact dimensions were disputed in trial court. However, it is undisputed that after Welch's body was discovered in the tank, the fireman that went down to retrieve the body was unable to go down into the tank through the hatch wearing his oxygen bottle because the hatch was too small. He had to go down there and have the bottle handed to him while he was down in the tank. Now, several oil field workers and the operator on the well testified, and their experience in the oil field approximates 100 years, and all these people testified that they had never seen or even heard of anyone falling through this hatch and into one of these tanks because the hatch was too small. Now, the gauging operation, or the duty to gauge that the derrick man Welch had, consisted of going up onto the tank by the ladder and looking down into this hatch and dropping a gauge, which is a tape measure attached to a heavy plumb bob, which is kind of like a yo-yo. And you reel this down here, and the bob is heavy, and it takes it all the way to the bottom, and you can gauge to determine how the oil well is flowing. Now, all these witnesses who testified, who had knowledge of the oil field practices, testified without exception that it is not necessary for the derrick man, in order to gauge the tank, to go down inside the tank. Further, all these witnesses testified that you're not supposed to go down there. It's dangerous to do so. The derrick man has no business inside the tank. And, in fact, there is absolutely no business affair of Jolly Well Service, the employer, which could in any particular be furthered by having the derrick man inside the tank. Now, it's also...
Have you got any suggestions why he would want to go into the tank?
Yes, Your Honor, we do. And we suggest that he was down there sniffing gas to get a high. And we have testimony from his best friend, which is the subject of the dispute and of the appeal. It's undisputed from all the people who testified that the fumes and gas being emitted from the crude oil in the tank was sweet gas. That is, it's not poisonous and would take a rather lengthy exposure for someone to feel the effects. Now, of course, the plaintiff contends that for some reason or by the fact that he was overcome by fumes, that he fell through this hatch into the tank and drowned. And, of course, we dispute this. We don't think it's possible for someone to have fallen in there in that fashion. And we think that someone to get down there would have to deliberately go down there.
Well, counsel, if he had his head stuck in the hole and then passed out, could he have fallen in?
That might be possible if he was there a lot longer than it normally took one to gauge the tank. There's no evidence that he had his head in the hole, and there's no reason for it. All you have to do is just run this yo-yo type of a thing down into the hatch. There's no reason or purpose to get down there. Now, of course, he was to hourly gauge this tank. That was his job. He had gauged
it's not a problem in this case as far as your appeal here today, though, is it? On Are we strictly involved with evidentiary problems in the case, the admissibility of evidence?
The point on appeal, Your Honor, is the admissibility of the testimony of Welch's best friend named Kenny Barnes.
And the objection for failure to object to that?
Yes, Your Honor. Welch had gauged the tank last about 2 o'clock. He would gauge it just about every hour on the hour. He failed to show for the 3 o'clock gauge. The operator, in fact, had to make the 3 p.m. gauge, and it's undisputed that the operator, when he crawled up upon that tank, found the gauge on top of the tank near the hatch. He did not find it down in the bottom of the tank. It was on top of the tank, where it was supposed to have been and expected to have been. The crew and the operator searched until dark the evening of April the 3rd of 1979, were unable to find Welch. They searched the next day. His body was finally found inside the frac tank after it had been partially drained. Now, it is with this factual basis and in light of the contention of the parties, that is, that the plaintiff was trying to sell the idea that he got overcome by gas or something and fell through the hatch, we are, of course, contending that Welch was intoxicated because the autopsy was performed on his body, and by two different methods and tests, both of which revealed the same result, that at the time of his death, Alan Wayne Welch had a blood alcohol content of 0.14. It was undisputed that neither of these tests would have been affected in any degree by exposure to crude oil or any other hydrocarbon. So the plaintiff in the trial court was saying that he fell through the hatch in the frac tank and drowned. We were saying that he was drunk and that he went down there to sniff gas. Now, it's with this background that the testimony of Kenny Barnes must be considered. Kenny Barnes was Alan Wayne Welch's best friend in life. He was also had been employed with Jolly Well Service, had worked with Welch. Shortly after this occurrence, a Texas employer's lawyer was investigating this and took a statement from the witness Barnes. Witness Barnes in the statement said that Alan Wayne Welch had admitted to him that on previous occasions he had gone into these tanks and had sniffed gas around there and gotten a high. Now, there was a motion in limine filed by the plaintiff.
Counselor, was his testimony that he had gone into the tanks and gotten high?
Well, I believe the testimony on voir dire was that the witness that Welch had admitted sniffing gas on prior occasions.
That's a lot different from getting into the tank.
Yes, Your Honor. The problem was is that the testimony of the witness Barnes was much different at the time of trial than the statement that had been given the Texas employer's investigating lawyer, because by the time of trial, the witness fully appreciated the effect of his testimony. Texas employers had to subpoena this witness, and he was at least a recalcitrant witness at trial because he knew what was going on at that time. Now, that was part of the problem with his testimony. Now, in response to the motion limine filed to have a bench conference prior to the admission of any evidence of any prior bad acts of Welch, a voir dire examination of the witness Barnes was conducted outside the presence of the jury. In the voir dire examination, Barnes testified that Welch had admitted a prior occasion of sniffing gas and getting high. Barnes also stated that he had suspected that Welch was in the tank because he had gone down there to get a high and thought that he could get high off of sniffing the gas. Now, at the end of the voir dire examination, the plaintiff made what she characterized as a motion to suppress. The motion to suppress is almost 2 pages in the statement of facts. However, the complaints made is that this admission that Welch had sniffed gas was not in any way incriminating, was highly prejudicial, was a matter of semantics, would tend to mislead the jury, was highly problematical, was immaterial and irrelevant for any purpose in the case. Now, the court overruled this so-called motion to suppress, and he did so in a very specific fashion as to the specific questions and answers referred to in the motion. Now, after the overruling of this motion to suppress, the plaintiff's counsel asked the trial court for an understanding that he need not renew his motion before the jury that he had made his objection to it, to which the court responded simply Mr. Pearson, if you are comfortable with the record in that state, that is perfectly all right with me. Thereupon, the jury was returned to the courtroom, and an examination of the witness Barnes continued before the jury. Barnes again testified as to Welch's admission that he had sniffed gas and had gotten high. No complaint of a substantive nature was made to this evidence before the jury. There was no renewal of the motions to suppress, even assuming that it contained a valid objection. There were a couple of objections made to the leading nature of the question, or that Texas Employers was trying to impeach a witness that it had called, which was overruled. No complaint is made about that on appeal. Now this brings us to our points of error and contentions before this court. We contend that the plaintiff failed to properly preserve any error for appellate review regarding this evidence on several bases. Number one, because there was no renewal of the motion to suppress. Number two, there was no valid specific objection made at the time that the evidence was offered to the jury. And number three...
There was no objection at all made at that time, was there?
No, ma'am. No, Your Honor, there sure was not. Except as to leading and trying to impeach the own witness, which was overruled, about which no complaint has been made. Thirdly, the plaintiff on appeal has sought to enlarge the scope of whatever objections may have been made after the voir dire examination, and in fact has raised new objections. So we contend that the Court of Appeals of Eastland has erred in holding that the plaintiff has properly preserved error for appellate review and did not have the burden to renew objection or otherwise make objection to Barnes' testimony when it came in before the jury. Secondly, this evidence was clearly admissible and relevant as circumstantial evidence of Welch's motive, intent, and purpose for being inside the frac tank. And therefore, the Court of Appeals erred in holding that it was inadmissible. Thirdly, the Court of Appeals erred in holding that Welch's motive, intent, and purpose for being inside the frac tank is immaterial unless it supports the defense of alcohol intoxication. Apparently, the Court of Appeals at Eastland is of the opinion that someone could be down in a frac tank sniffing gas and die, and that would be a compensable injury within the course and scope of employment. We certainly do not agree. Lastly, if there was any error, we believe the error was harmless, because the jury had ample evidence by which it could have concluded, and probably did conclude, that Welch was not in the course and scope of his employment at the time of his death because he was intoxicated by alcohol. Or the jury may have decided that just for being down there unless it was shown that there was a business purpose, that just for being down there he was outside the scope and course of his employment, and there's ample evidence to support that. Turning to our point of error on waiver, the Court of Appeals in Houston in 1971 in a refused NRE case, Reasoner versus State, has suggested that we do not have such an animal in the civil practice in Texas as a motion to suppress. However, the Court simply treated the motion to suppress made in that case as a motion in limine. So what we're dealing with here is the motion to suppress made by the plaintiff is a motion in limine. It is well settled from the Hartford accident versus McCardle case of this court, and a host of authorities which have relied on and cited McCardle for the well settled rule that a ruling or an overruling of a motion in limine can never be error, that the error occurs at the time the evidence complained of is admitted before the trier of fact, in this case before the jury.
Counselor, in the reasoning case, at what point in the proceedings was this motion in limine heard?
Your Honor, the motion to suppress was made, I believe, that involved the testimony of a police officer, and it was made prior to the evidence being admitted before the trier of fact.
Well, I'm talking about, was it made back in the judge's office where you ordinarily hear motions in limine, or was it in this case where on voir dire in the middle of the trial, judge on the bench listening to the witness?
I don't recall that the opinion specified whether it was in chambers or just outside the presence of the jury.
Think it make any difference whether or not it was
no, Your Honor,
objection?
No, Your Honor, I certainly do not. In other words, the real issue and the contention by the plaintiff is that, well, after you've made a motion in limine and gone to all the trouble of having a voir dire examination, then it would be a useless thing to require a party to renew the objections after a voir dire examination before the jury. And, of course, we disagree with that for several reasons. Number one, the whole point of requiring specific and valid objections is to give the trial court a fair shot at knowing what the specific question asked and the specific answer given in light of the specific objection.
You don't think it'd make any difference sitting back in the judge's office, the lawyer say, Judge, I'm going to put on this evidence, this kind. The judge said, well, I'll sustain or overrule the motion. The judge sitting there, the witness testifying, specific questions, and then an objection is made. You don't think there'd be any difference in those two situations?
No, Your Honor, because there's absolutely no guarantee that the voir dire examination is going to be the same as that which occurs before the jury. In other words, sure, by a motion in limine in judge's chamber, the judge gets a preview of coming attractions, as it were, to what's coming up. On voir dire examination, he finds out what the witness is going to testify to, basically, but there's absolutely no guarantee that the questions asked or answers given are going to be the same before the jury as they are in voir dire. And I suggest to you, Justices, that an untenable situation occurs when you start speculating on whether an objection made in a voir dire examination occurs to or applies to testimony before the jury, where although the same subject matter is being examined over, it's not the same question exactly, and it's not the same answer.
What if the objection is exactly the same, the testimony is exactly the same, would you still require an objection?
Yes, Your Honor, because that forces an appeal to tell whether it's the same. And there's no reason for such an appeal, because we ought to give the trial judges and the parties to the lawsuit every...
It seems to me to make trial of the cases turn on rather small technicalities. It's gamesmanship. The judge has been advised of what he's going to present. He's made a ruling. Now, why make him make it twice?
Well, in fact, there is a case where State versus Locke.
I don't care if there is another one. I'm asking, you know, administration of justice, where we're going.
Right. If the rule is that you do not have to renew your objection, then...
I didn't ask you what the rule was. What's the reason for the rule? If the objection is the same, the testimony is the same, what is accomplished?
Well, nothing may be accomplished if it is, but the problem is there is no guarantee that it's going to be. So how do you know when you have to renew your objection and when you do not? If the question is different and if the answer is different, there may be some error before the jury which was different from that which was brought out on voir dire. The point is, you don't know. So the easiest and judicial economy demands that simply the objection be renewed, because if you get into appeal like this case, you've got much more time and expense wasted by these parties in reversing a trial court judgment than you do in taking another couple of seconds during the trial of the case to renew objections, to give the trial court the benefit of knowing the precise, exact question asked and specific objection made. So that there's no need to speculate, well, is this exactly the same? You have to recall on memory about what may have happened before lunch, after the noon recess. You may have had a voir dire examination after you sent the jury out to lunch, and then you take up these matters about 11:30 or 12, and then about 2 or 2:30 you come back, and so you've got to recall on your memory is exactly what the question was. It's easy to tell whether it was the same when you got it in black and white in the record, but it's not that way in the trial court.
You also got the opportunity to go ahead and ask the question, get it before the jury when the judge has said you can't do it too, don't you? If the judge had sustained the objection to start with.
Yes, Your Honor, but if the question itself is inflammatory, Well, then certainly the party that does that faces the wrath of the trial court and reversal. And so the trial court can give specific instructions, say, Mr. Lawyer, you're not to ask that question because the mere asking the question is inflammatory. So that's a situation that can be handled in the trial court. There was nothing particularly inflammatory about the nature of these questions in this case.
So why have the preliminary hearing of the early ruling? It doesn't amount to anything.
Well, yes, Your Honor, it certainly does because it apprises the trial court of what's coming so that he can think about it. If he has that lunch recess, he can go back and pull a law book if he needs to.
He can do that without anybody making an objection.
Yes, Your Honor, but it facilitates a more orderly trial and a more orderly appellate record.
It facilitates pitfalls for the unwary.
Counsel, you said there was a case on this subject. Would you tell us about what that case says?
Yes, Your Honor. The case being relied upon by the plaintiff, there are two cases. The estate of Brown versus Masco Corporation, a no writ civil appeals opinion from Beaumont. This case involved the deposition testimony of an investigating police officer. Pursuant to a motion in limine file, the deposition of the investigating officer was read outside the presence of the jury to determine its admissibility. By way of making his objections, the plaintiff's lawyer in that case marked the place in the deposition where he wanted to object. These objections, if that's what they were overruled, and the deposition was read to the jury. Now, when it came on appeal, the plaintiff contended error in the admission of some of this evidence. But the difference in that case is that the defendant in that case, as pointed out by the court and on page 106 of its opinion, was that appellee's defendants do not contend before us that plaintiffs waived this objection by failing to renew it. And therefore the case is dicta. Basically what the case held was that under that circumstance, the objection need not be renewed. Now, of course, there's another very important distinction in our case is that when you're dealing with a deposition testimony, the questions won't change because they're in black and white. When you're admitting a deposition into evidence, you can't ask any more or different questions because the witness is not present. Here, the witness was present on live, so you've got no guarantee. The other case was State versus Locke. In that case, there was a motion limine which was overruled. The court was admitting evidence before the jury. The defense lawyer in that case stood up and renewed his objections, albeit in a more casual fashion than he had specifically addressed in the motion limine. So we believe that because the plaintiff failed to renew these objections or make any other objections time of trial, that they waived the error. You'll note that they're talking about evidence being prejudicial, being a matter of semantics, being highly problematical. Well, these are no objections. What the trial court had to do is sift through all these frivolous objections to get to the possibility of any real objections being made, and simply that was immaterial and irrelevant. I suggest to you that it's no wonder that the trial court overruled this motion to suppress. We think that the evidence was clearly admissible to show motive and purpose for being in the tank. And we think that the motive and the purpose for being in the tank was very important. Now, throughout the trial and on appeal, the plaintiff has tried to liken these cases to the long line of cases where you're trying to admit prior acts or instances of insobriety to prove present intoxication. And that's what the civil appeals went off on. And we contend that that is a misconstruction of what we're arguing about. We were not trying to show necessarily that Welch was intoxicated by sniffing gas at the time, just that was his purpose for being in the tank. Now, we've cited two cases which we think are in line and will serve as authority. The Great American Indemnity versus Elledge case decided by this court in 1959. That was a case in which an employee was found dead on his employer's premises early in the morning. No one knew what he was doing there. The court admitted and found relevant a declaration by the deceased before he died that his, to the effect that his employer had been requesting that he stay out and sleep out at the plant. Similarly, in TEIA versus White, an employee was found dead after his car careened off a cliff. No one knew where it was going. The court admitted a declaration from the decedent that he was needed to go to a distant city to collect some money for his employer. We see no difference or distinction with our situation. The Court of Civil Appeals did not analyze or provide us any distinction in their opinion. The plaintiff has never provided any distinction. We think that this was relevant and material as circumstantial evidence to show Welch's motive, intent, and purpose from being in the tank.
Is Barnes' testimony tied down to any particular time when this decedent had gotten high?
No, Your Honor, just that it was in the oil field and that it was sometime prior to the death.
Then how could it have any bearing on what he was doing on that particular day? It could have been 2 years ago, couldn't it?
Well, he had not, my recollection of the record is that he had not been employed by Jolly Well Service near that long, so I don't think it could have been then.
Does the testimony show that he wasn't working in the oil field 2 years?
But in light of the overwhelming evidence, Your Honor, that there is no explanation or no business purpose for him being in the tank, and in light of the evidence that he was already intoxicated, we think that this is relevant as circumstantial evidence for his intent for being there. No one knows really why he was there, except Alan Wayne Welch and the Lord. Now, we simply cannot believe that the Court of Appeals would hold that sniffing gas is within the course and scope of your employment. We believe that certainly there has to be a business purpose for Welch being inside the tank. There's no evidence of that. Plaintiff failed to sustain her burden of proof as to that issue. So we think that this is material, even though it may not be supportive of alcohol intoxication. Lastly, we believe that this is harmless error. Of course, Rule 434 requires that to be constitute reversal, the evidence must be prejudicial, reasonably calculated to cause, and probably did cause the rendition of an improper verdict. Now, how can it be said that this probably caused the rendition of an improper verdict? First of all, we don't know. There's nothing in the record by which we know that the jury even considered this. We do know that the record has ample evidence from which the jury could have concluded that Welch was not in the course and scope of his employment by reason of alcohol intoxication, or simply not in the course and scope by simply being in the tank. Secondly, how can this cause the rendition of an improper verdict? How can it be improper for a jury to fail to find course and scope when the decedent has a blood alcohol content of 0.14? This is not improper. We don't know that the jury even considered it, and therefore we feel that even if there was error in the admission of Barnes' testimony, even if plaintiff properly preserved this error for appellate review, that is harmless.
Thank you, counsel. Your argument from respondent.
May I plead the court? Argument for respondent will be presented by Mr. James Pearson.
Gentlemen, court. I presume.
You want to amend that?
Sir?
You want to amend your opening remarks?
No, sir.
You want to include Judge Sondock?
Oh, pardon me. Well, as Dale Barber once said, when you give a person enough rope, they'll sink an ambulance.
How about may it please the court?
At any rate, I would presume that since the court in this case has granted this application on points 1, 4, and 5 of the petitioner's application, they're concerned mainly with did we properly preserve our error for ruling by this court or any other court. And 2, 4 was they took issue with the Court of Appeals that held the issue then of why Welch was in the tank was immaterial unless it affords Texas employers support as to its alleged defense of intoxication. And the other error, five, was whether or not if the error was made, if the erroneous evidence was admitted, and if we had a proper objection, was it harmless error? Now, because the court did not grant their application on their long argument and statement concerning all of the admissibility of this thing, of whether or not Allen once told his friend that on one occasion that he sniffed gas on the job and got a high, the court didn't grant the application. So I'm assuming that the court did not go along with that argument.
Counsel, it doesn't mean that. It just means we grant the writ on points we thought would save time for other points.
All right, so...
Not necessarily mean that.
Right. Well, so... but in reply, I was going to say, in reply to what he had to say about the admissibility, the way it was, Kenny Barnes was the decedent's very best friend for years. And on the day of the funeral, which was evidently the day after they had found him drowned in the oil, and amongst his tears and crying, they interrogated him and took him on a tape recorder and asking him why, how, is there any reason that this man is dead? And then they come up and put him on the stand, and he says that at one time prior to, prior, didn't say when, like judge says here, it could have been 5 years ago, 2 years ago, we don't know when it was, at a time. Didn't say it was more than one time. But at some time, we don't know when, why, or where, Allen admitted, or stated, I'm using Camp's terminology now, stated to the his friend that once on the job, he sniffed gas and got a high. Now, the question is, well, is that admissible to show that he was sniffing gas on the occasion in question? In other words, can you show, like in one case that I've cited in the brief there, that because the railroad trainman went to sleep, the engineer went to sleep every time he made his run along this particular thing, that he was asleep on the day that the wreck occurred? That can you show that he had gone to sleep before, one time way back there, as the train ran by this stop, and there was, so therefore he was probably asleep again while the train ran. Of course, the judge back there in this court held that you couldn't show whatever a man did on a prior occasion has nothing to do with what he does on the occasion in question.
Well, in this case, they found 1.4, is that what it is, of intoxication of alcohol.
Blood alcohol. The pathologist found that.
Now, what are you going to do with this case with that finding?
Well, that was the intoxication issue. And that the evidence was highly contested on intoxication. First place, most of the judges, their own evidence, the pathologist testified that 1.4 doesn't say that everybody's intoxicated. That's the only evidence they had on intoxication. Everybody else said that he was not intoxicated.
Didn't it say 95% of the people would be inclined to be intoxicated?
He said some percent of them would, yes, but not everyone.
95%, isn't that what he said?
But he also said that that the best people that would be in a position to determine whether or not he was intoxicated on the day in question would be those who observed him and knew him. And all of those people testified, plus others that hadn't known him prior, but they all testified he showed no signs of intoxication whatsoever. No signs of intoxication whatsoever. And they'd been with him from 8 o'clock that morning until the time he disappeared at 2:20 in the afternoon.
But But
anyway,
they saw him between 2 and 5, did they?
No. The last time they saw him was 2:20. The operator saw him at 2:20. He gauged the tank at 2:20, turned in his gauge report to the operator. The operator saw him then, and then they saw him no more. No one saw him anymore.
And no one really knows what time he fell in the tank.
No one knows. That's right. He disappeared at 2:20, and that's why we have always contended this is a classic case of the unexplained death doctrine in the Scott case. And the Deathwish cases, here's a man on a job doing what he's supposed to do, doing what he's hired to do, and disappears, and he's found dead where he's supposed to be, where he was doing what he's supposed to be doing during the hours that he was working. So this is a case of the unexplained death case, and so the presumption would be that he was in the course and scope of his employment on all phases, except whether or not they could prevail on their defense of intoxication.
Counsel, there's some difference in the record from your presentation. Counsel for petitioner said he was not supposed to be in the tank, and I understood you to say he was where he was supposed to be.
He was supposed to gauge the tank. He was supposed to go up here, take this plumb bob, which was on a string, let it down to the bottom of the tank.
I'm suggesting he was supposed to be in the tank.
No, but he was, but...
That's all I asked.
Well, let me get to what, for an example, on page 30 of their application for writ of error, and I think the other side states, and I think it's true, says the problem is that no one really knows how Welch got inside the tank or why he was there.
Isn't that why the evidence may be admissible that you can crawl in one of those tanks and sniff gas?
Well, there's no...
Me. I didn't know that you...
Yeah, but there's no evidence in this case that he voluntarily went in the tank at all. There's no evidence in this case.
One explanation of why somebody would go in there. I could have thought the rest of the week without giving a reason why somebody would crawl in the tank.
Well, there's no evidence that he crawled in the tank, Judge. That's the point I'm making. There is no evidence that he voluntarily went in this tank. Now, Sir?
You say it was falling in?
He could have. It was, most of the witnesses testified it was 30 to 36 by 36, the opening was. And to gauge the tank, he'd crawl up the ladder. He looked down in this hole and let the plumb bob down into the tank. The gas was coming out. Their pathologist testified that he got overcome by the vapors and fell in the tank and drank. And it was 30 by 30, you can see exhibit number 9, you can look at the hole, and it's big enough for anything to go in. Now, I would like to point out one thing about this sniffing of what, sir?
Back to a question that didn't get fully answered a while ago about when he disappeared. Now, do I recall something in the statement of facts to the fact that they started looking for him at 3 o'clock, he made a gauging at 2:20, and they started looking at 3, and that's when he was gone?
That's when he was gone. They missed him at 3 o'clock. That was during his hours of work, yes. And that's why we think it's an unexplained death case. All right, now, as to the admissibility of this evidence, go back to Dean Wigmore. Here we're trying to show that a man did something on the day in question by virtue of the fact that he had stated that at one time prior he had done the same thing to show that he had did it again. Now, Wigmore says, nature of the inference, an act is not evidential of another act. At the outset of this entire prospective class of inferences, it must be noted that where the doing of an act is a proposition to be proved, there can never be a direct inference from an act of former conduct to the act charged. There must always be a double step or of inference of some sort, a tetrum quid. In other words, it cannot be argued because A did an act X last year, he therefore probably did act X as now charged. Human action being indefinitely varied, there is no adequate probative connection between the two. A may do the act once and may never do it again. And not only may he not do it again, but it is no degree probable that he will do it again. The conceivable contingencies that may intervene are too numerous. The principle has long been accepted in our law that the doing of one act is of in itself no evidence that the same or like act was again done by the same person, has been so often judicially repeated that it is commonplace.
To go back to the answer you gave Justice Wallace, are you suggesting that the employer and or any of the co-employees started looking for this man before 5 o'clock?
No.
So that your answer to him that they were looking for him at 3 o'clock when he
no.
missed that?
At 3 exactly. o'clock, it was his time to gauge the tank. And the operator charged up the rig to try to bring him, to let him know it was time.
Well,
to
in the interest of time, just to, were you mistaken then when you answered Judge Wallace again? You meant to indicate that they did not miss him, in fact, until 5
no,
o'clock.
No, they missed him at 3 o'clock.
But they didn't look for him until 5.
Well, he looked for him by charging up the rig. That was a signal for people to come in when you gun it, you know, and rev it up. And he didn't come in, so the operator went up and gauged the tank himself at 3. But then they didn't start looking at for him until 5. That's correct. All right, so that's the way it was. In other words, we don't think that the evidence was admissible under any theory whatsoever. And I think that all our brief is very explicit on this point. We've cited all the authorities. We know it's not. As held by the Eastland Court of Appeals, our objection, it was immaterial and irrelevant. It was immaterial and irrelevant of the rankest sort. Here they are. They had a piece of evidence that was very damaging, that was devastating to the plaintiff's case, and they started trying from the first day of trial to get it in evidence. The plaintiff filed a motion in limine where the court instructed him not to bring any acts of past misconduct without approaching the bench and getting permission to introduce it. After that, they approached the bench. They come up with Kenny Barnes. They put him under the order of the court. They put him on voir dire examination. He got on there and he testified. He testified at length and he said everything that he knew about the case. Then there was a lot of discussion. And both sides presented all their views, which had been being presented all during the trial of the case. There was no way for the court not to be aware of everybody's position, because this had been going on since the first day of trial for 3 days. They've been trying to get this evidence in. So we put him on voir dire. This was a bit of evidence that was inadmissible. It was very harmful. And that's why we have motions in limine. And that's why we try to keep things like that from the jury. And I might say, gentlemen, there's one thing juries are in their human way. They want to hear all the evidence, the inadmissible evidence, as well as the admissible evidence. And they get mad at any side that tries to keep from them anything. And so this was a very ticklish situation. It was inadmissible. All right. After we got through, I made the plaintiff's objection. And I stated, now come the plaintiff at a time when the jury has been excused of their court and at a time when the court proceeded to hear the testimony on voir dire out of the presence of the jury to permit the plaintiff to make any objection that he might want to make. That had been the understanding. We made our objection in full. All right? After the objection was made, the court denied it. As to the specific question and answers as contained in the motion. All right, now, the specific question, answers and question was, what did he tell you prior about sniffing gas? Said at one time, he said, while on the job, he sniffed gas and got a high. That was the whole thing. The court knew exactly what was. Everybody knew exactly what we were talking about. The court ruled on the objection as to the exact thing in question. All right, then I said, Your Honor, could we have an understanding that we do not have to renew our motion when he asks the question, when the jury comes in, that we made our objection to it. Now, no one wants to tell the jury, I'm trying to keep you from hearing vital.
Counsel, I'm fully aware a fellow who repeatedly objects finds no favor with the jury.
That's right.
But that, our question is an objection excused? The rule is that you can't sit there and let the evidence come in. Now, I'm not saying that you didn't preserve it, but the narrow question before us is, once a matter is presented in a motion in limine and the judge makes a rule, and then later you come into court and you develop the same thing, do you or do you not have to make an objection?
Well, that's what I was getting right to. The next thing the court replied was, said it was all right with him.
Okay. Excuse me, I didn't know what he said.
That's what I understood him to say, sir. And that, I think...
He said if you would be...
If you feel comfortable with the record in that position, that is perfectly all right with me.
You're not suggesting that court kept you from making a proper objection at a later date time, are you?
I'm saying that I understood that I had a running objection to it then, and I think the court understood it. I think Judge Kirk understood it. I still feel like he understood it. All right, now the thing about it was...
I may think of your position, counsel. How do you distinguish Hartford action against McCarty?
All right. Hartford, the Hartford case, was a case where, like the judge pointed out a while ago, a motion in limine was thrown to the court in early in the game. Well, when you're talking about evidence that might be introduced into a trial, that's one thing. But when you're talking about evidence that's actually tendered to the court for introduction before the jury.
If the motion in limine was that morning.
Yeah, like it was the first day on Monday.
And the evidence was tendered at 10 o'clock, that would be different?
The evidence was tendered on, I think it was Thursday morning, about 10 o'clock, Monday to Thursday. Now, in the Hartford case, another thing about the Hartford case, that was a case where a motion in limine was overruled on the first day of trial, but still there was other objections, and that was just part of the decision. The court went ahead and ruled on the objections in the next syllabi. Now, the case that you asked about a while ago on the Reasoner case, what he was thinking about the Brown
case. As I understand, McCarter says if there were in fact to ask to offer an objection made at the time is necessary to preserve the right to complain on appeal, do we overrule that or do we follow it?
Well, I think what is the reason to, what are you going to have motion in limine? What is the reason to keep bad evidence out? Why should we let the jury hear bad evidence that along the line? Now, you've got the Locke case that says that all the man has to do is say, Judge, I renew my objection. That's kind of like, you know, you don't have to restate your objection at all. You don't have to state it when the evidence is being offered before the jury. That's what the Locke case says.
No, but at that point, your pointing is a thing that you don't like. Six questions, it just takes one question to destroy a case in some instances. But that's the point at which this lawyer comes alive and says, this is the thing I'm objecting to. And as I understand the law, that's the way it is.
Well, of course, now, you got the Brown case where...
Not the Brown case, but
you got the Masco case. Brown versus Masco, where they had the deposition of the officer. They went through it completely, and they made all their objections, and then later on, the evidence was objected for the jury, and no objection was made, and they ruled on it appeal. The Court of Civil Appeals in this case followed that rule.
But if Hartford is overruled, aren't you in effect giving the trial lawyer the option of not making the objection before the jury?
No, I think this, Your Honor, I think any time, evidence is specifically identified and pointed up to the court. An objection is specifically made where everybody can understand it. Every side has had an opportunity to present their views, and the court has made a fair ruling on that. Then he's made an objection to that testimony. And that's what we did in this case.
It shouldn't be even brought up again, should it?
Sir?
And I said it shouldn't even be brought up again.
No, that's what I think. That's
so
what I think.
We don't have a problem having to object twice.
That's correct. And then...
If you bring it up, you just put the lawyer in jail and let him stop that one. That's short.
Well, the Court of Appeals here points out that same thing, that there are cases at home that you don't have to object and object and object every time the poisonous evidence is offered.
But your suggestion would in fact prevent or help an attorney who does not want to make an objection to what he knows is very harmful to his client in front of the jury, knowing that juries don't like you to give the impression you're trying to suppress evidence. Is that a fair statement?
That's right. This gives a man a chance to have the court rule on evidence and determine whether or not it's going to be admitted before the jury or not, and then let it go on and not kick a man.
But if that evidence is harmful to you, and if that judge determines it is admissible, then that evidence comes in with your sitting down before the jury, not being forced to make an objection, and not have to make that decision as to whether or not you in fact want to object in front of the jury. Because trial attorneys have to make that decision all the time, don't they?
That's right, they do. But Your Honor, in this case...
But this permits you to do outside the presence of the jury what you should in fact have to do in front of the jury.
No, but now, the way I see it, ladies and gentlemen, we've got this problem. This Hartford case is a court-made statement. All of this is court-made. None of it's legislative.
Well,
now, the difference between the facts of the case are totally different. The facts of this case is totally different from the Hartford case. And so I don't think the Hartford case is stare decisis in this case. Because in the Hartford case, that was a motion in limine that was presented on Monday morning. In this case, we've got a voir dire examination where the evidence was tendered for presentation to the jury, where everybody knew what it was. We weren't talking about something in left field over there or out in the pasture, or something that we didn't know for sure about. We were talking about something specific. And the objection was made. And we requested that we be given the right not to object again. Well, I see my time. Thanks.
You've got 5 minutes, sir.
Oh, I have? All right.
The red light is your get down time.
All right. All right. Well, anyway.
Counsel, I'd like you to comment about the harmless error. You come into the Court of Civil Appeals with a jury finding against you. When you appeal to the Court of Civil Appeals, you have the burden to show harm, and that's reasonably calculated to cause such harm case should be reversed. Do you feel that in this case, looking at the record as a whole, that the harmless error rule should not apply?
Oh, definitely, Your Honor. You read this whole record in this case and the argument and the voir dire examination where they said, see, there is no evidence in this case that this boy sniffed gas on the day in question. No evidence whatsoever. No evidence whatsoever. Not, in fact, in response to our request for admission, they admitted that there were no witnesses. Nobody knew why he went in the tank. Nobody knew anything about it. There was nothing but the speculation of the defense counsel that he was sniffing gas. They first started out saying that he intentionally injured himself. But there is not one bit of evidence in this case that he was sniffing gas on the day in question. There is no evidence, just like I pointed out, that they admitted of how he got in the tank or why.
The thing that's concerning me is the jury had before it. We got to look at this from their point of view. The jury had before it evidence that this man had been drinking. And the jury had before it the fact that this was a rather unusual thing for a workman who didn't have to get up on top of this thing, and yet somehow or other he fell through this thing.
Judge, McArdle versus Gravelberg talks about this, showing whether or not the error is harmful under 434. We do not have the burden to show that but for this evidence, some other result would have occurred. We only have to show that it probably caused an improper verdict. We don't have to, and in fact, in McCarver versus Gravelberg, the court stated specifically, we cannot say that if this evidence had been excluded, some other result would have occurred.
No, the rule says, and all you've got, all one has to show is that it was such a denial of the rights of persons as reasonably calculated to cause, and probably did cause, the rendition of an improper judgment.
That's correct. And so, all, and the McCarty versus Gravelberg is always cited by the court, and that case holds that as long as it was probable, and in that case, McCarty versus Gravelberg, they held. They said the defense comes in and says that there was other evidence on the issue, and therefore it was harmless, and says even though there was other harmless, other evidence, we cannot go along with that because we think that it must be deemed to have been harmful. And if you read McCarty versus Gravelberg, it'll present that thing in full. In the thing. Now, I would like to say this about harmful error. In their argument to the jury, says, well, what reason did he have for going down there if he went down there voluntarily? Now, remember, there is no evidence that he went voluntarily in the tank. None whatsoever. None whatsoever. If he went down there voluntarily, let's assume he went down there voluntarily. We know that he had sniffed gas on other occasions to get a high. Now the witness that we were compelled to subpoena, Kenny Barnes, was his closest friend. Kenny Barnes was not for us. Kenny Barnes is close to this lady, Ms. Welch. Here is Alan's closest friend. He definitely was on the other side. We subpoenaed him and put him on the stand, and he said, yes, Alan told me that he had sniffed gas. And he wanted to say after being prodded by Jim Pearson that he meant smell gas like everyone else in the oil field. That's not what he said in the statement taken the day Alan's body was found. He said, Alan told me he had sniffed gas and gotten high before. Sniffed gas. Sniffed gas denotes a voluntary, purposeful thing. That doesn't sound like to me going out there and just happening to run into a little gas like a man would do when he is working. When you say sniff gas, that means they were sniffing it on purpose, trying to get a high. And that is what his best friend told David Cobb. And then on, and you can read it there. There's no doubt about the harmful of the error. It destroyed the lawsuit.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. I feel it's obvious from the many questions that you've asked both me and Mr. Pearson that you're well aware of the myriad of problems that we get into if we start making exceptions to the well-recognized rule that to preserve error, you've got to object at the time the error is capable of being made, that is, when it comes in before the jury. Now, I'll submit to you that we avoid all these problems by simply have lawyers do what they do, and that's lawyer, and object at the time that the evidence is admitted before the jury. We simply avoid all these problems. We don't have to worry about, well, is the voir dire question going to be the same as the question before the jury? Is the evidence or the answer is going to be exactly the same? Is the objection going to be the same? We just avoid all that. A judge has had a little better preview of coming attractions by way of voir dire examination than he may have had in chambers and a motion in limine. It is no reason to change the rule. Too many problems are created by making an exception to the rule, and all these problems will have to be resolved on appeal. And I suggest to you that much more time and expense and effort is wasted on appeal when it could be taken care of in the trial court at the time the error is made, when the evidence comes in before the jury. Now, we disagree that Mr. Pearson had a running objection. Note that the trial judge says, "Mr. Pearson, your motion to suppress is overruled as to the specific questions and answers in the motion." Now, I think the judge was telling Mr. Pearson, well, you know, the question may be different out there in front of the jury, and if it is, I'll rule on it then, in light of whatever objection you care to make. Then simply saying, "Mr. Pearson, if you feel comfortable with the record in that position, that's perfectly all right with me. I see no authorization for any running objection in that." Thirdly, I don't know of any law where the trial court has the power to alter the rules concerning preservation of error for appeal. I don't think the trial court was trying to do that.
Are you saying you don't think a trial court can grant a running objection?
Yes, Your Honor, when it's before when the evidence is coming in before the jury and there's numerous cases so holding. In other words, if you're in front of the jury and you've asked a question and a ruling has been made, well, your adversary need not continually object. And I think it's continual objections that the jury finds disfavor with. Not a lawyer representing his client's right and objecting. All the jurors expect that. Now, note the difference between what Mr. Pearson said at trial court and what he said today on appeal. In front of the trial judge, and I have scoured the record, and I respectfully request that each of you justices scour the record, because you won't find a whole lot of squabbling going on and making of all these objections about this evidence. You will find one motion to suppress of about a page and a half, and that's all. That's the only objections that were made in the record. So we challenged this idea about everybody knew what the objections were and what was going on. If you were the trial judge and someone came to you and said, "Judge, that's not in any way incriminating. That's highly prejudicial. It's a matter of semantics. It's tended to mislead the jury. It's highly problematical, immaterial, and irrelevant for any purpose in the case." What kind of objection is that? Now we're talking about showing of habits and antecedent acts and talking about failure to establish predicates for pecuniary interest and all like that, what was not remotely before the trial court. No wonder the trial court overruled such a motion, because the only possible objections that were made was immaterial and irrelevant, and then the plaintiff did not favor the trial court with an explanation as to why that would be so if it is. But yet
the objection that something is irrelevant is a general objection, but sometimes that's what it is. And that is the objection. Doesn't have anything to do.
Well, yes, Your Honor, but I think a party that makes such a general objection ought to have the burden, and does have the burden, to point out to the judge why it's immaterial or how it's irrelevant. And none of this was done here. This came on the tail end of a long colloquy of frivolous and non-objections. So the trial court had to sift through all this. It's no wonder why he overruled the motion to suppress. And yet to face him with reversal when the plaintiff could and should have renewed specific objections when the evidence came in is an injustice, because it wastes time and expense for the courts and for all the parties. Obviously, the plaintiff is not content with the objections made on appeal, because they've sought to enlarge them and expand on them and make different. There was nothing. This Mr. Pearson's brief contains attacks on our evidence for not showing a proper predicate of habit, a proper predicate of demonstrating that the time it was made, it was against the pecuniary interest of Alan Wayne Welch. There's absolutely nothing like that in the record of the trial court. You just can't allow such a motion unrenewed, and then have a party come before the appellate court and blindside him and get reversed. It's just not fair. Now, on the issue of intoxication, there's no dispute that the blood alcohol content was 0.14. Now, Mr. Pearson would like a presumption. So if he would like a presumption, I'd be happy to provide one. The only presumption we can make about what Alan Wayne Welch did between his disappearance at about 2 o'clock and when he was found was drank alcohol. And we can presume that because he had a blood alcohol content of 0.14. And I submit to you with that evidence, the Scott Deathridge case and all the rest are inapplicable because the presumption of death and course and scope when an employee is found dead where he might reasonably have been only applies when there is no evidence that he was not in the course and scope. Here there is an abundance of evidence. 0.14 blood alcohol and all the testimony that he had no business inside the tank. Now, Mr. Pearson would like to forget the state chemist, the DPS chemist that testified that that in his experience virtually everybody would be intoxicated. I think when you read the record it will become abundantly clear that the squabble was not over whether someone would be intoxicated or had been drinking on the job with that amount of blood alcohol, but what we might expect the exact effects to be. Not whether there was intoxication, but how much intoxication there may have been. Again, there's been no analysis from either the plaintiff or the Court of Appeals as to harmless error. The Court of Appeals just said the reversible error. That's it. We have never been told why or how an improper verdict could be rendered, or an improper judgment could be rendered, given the evidence that Welch had 0.14 blood alcohol content and was not supposed to be down in the tank. Now, the operator testified that the hatch, if I may demonstrate to the court, was about this big, about 18 by 24. Now, what plaintiff would have you believe is that Alan Wayne Welch climbed up that ladder on the end of that frac tank and got a good whiff of that gas while he was gauging the tank and was rendered, I guess, semi-conscious or unconscious and fell, a grown man falling through a space this big. I submit to you that...
That just seems so hard to me, counsel.
Well, Judge Greenhill, I respectfully disagree. That just seems fantastical to me.
That may be a jury question, but I think I could fall on a whole level.
I just... Falling clear through a hole that size, it's just obviously the jury found it was on beyond belief anyway. Someone who is semi-conscious or unconscious just don't believe that could happen. Therefore, we would request that this honorable court reverse the judgment and of the Court of Appeals and render judgment in accordance with the jury verdict and the trial court's judgment that the plaintiff take nothing for the reasons that they have waived any error on appeal by failing to renew their objections at the time the evidence was offered before the jury, that they did not otherwise make a proper, valid, and specific objection at the time the evidence came before the jury, and that they have sought improperly to expand and assert different grounds of error on appeal. Secondly, the evidence was not inadmissible. It was admissible as circumstantial evidence to show Alan Wayne Welch's motive, intent, and purpose for being in the tank, and therefore there was no error. If there was any error, however, it was clearly harmless because we have no assurance that the jury paid any attention to this gas-sniffing business at all. Their verdict and the judgment rendered thereon is totally proper given the evidence that Alan Wayne Welch was intoxicated with a blood alcohol content of 0.14, or simply that he had no business purpose that was ever demonstrated for having been in that tank, and there is no evidence that his presence in the tank had anything to do with the business affairs of Jolly Well Service. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted on written brief and oral argument for both parties. The court will take a brief recess.
All in, please rise.